This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi everyone, we're recording. Welcome to TVI episode 206. Live from our houses. I've been away, I've been in Edinburgh and in the Lake District. So I've only just got back, hence.
What were you doing in the Lake District?
Fishing. Burying some bodies.
That's what I think, mine. Don't dig in your mine up by accident.
No, I just swung back for a couple of days to visit a friend on the way back from Edinburgh. It's so nice. We'll chat about this. We'll introduce our guest and then we'll talk. We're joined by a comedian I've been on before, but I think second appearance on
to, second time.
It's Adam Bloom, everyone. Comedian.
One of my favourite human
now
beings.
Now author. You're back on. Excellent timing. Today is the release of your book, which is very exciting. I didn't actually notice it was today. I thought it was tomorrow, but, you know, that's fine.
No, it was tomorrow. Amazon brought it out a day early. Okay. They surprised me.
It's called Finding Your Comic Genius. And it's a proper, like, you know, it's a proper guide to comedy, as well as obviously covering your background in it as well. It's not, you know, it's a sort of, what it's like, because you've got like an encyclopedic knowledge of comedy. You're very different.
Bit Rain Man.
Not like me and Julie. Yeah. We can't even remember our own jokes. you're very interested in the mechanics of comedy. It's exciting. You've written a book about it. I'm looking forward to reading it. Julian's back in his mum's house for a bit. Anyone who's looking at.
I'm at my dad's, and we're both trying to hide the background of that.
I'm at my own house.
Like this.
He's rented. I'm at some random person's house. Technically, I just rent it off them.
So have you inherited the house, Adam?
Yeah, my dad died last year, and my sister and I have inherited stuff. So I've moved in to empty it. It's been a colossal job. It's taken my sister, my brother-in-law, and me a year to not empty it yet.
What? Because my dad died last year, and I emptied out my parents. I mean, it was a council flat, and so like it wasn't like there was probate or anything. I had like a window of time I had to have it cleared by, but it's a weird process emptying out your parents' place.
It's tough, and you've got to be brutal. Yeah. You can't go that. You can't have sentimental value about everything, otherwise you won't have space to put it all.
No.
Because you've got your own possessions right?
Yeah. And what's... Except for the money, it's quite sentimental, isn't it? The
cash. Sentimental about cash.
Oh, we've got to keep this, you know.
It's what you would have wanted.
You've got to put it in my box, please.
I had a really, I had a really touching moment. My sister found a box, and inside the box was almost every review I've ever had since 1996.
Yeah.
Oh. Newspapers and Edinburgh Festival.
Is that Harry Dyer?
No, he died of shame when he found the box that I hid in his house with all my reviews.
That's so sweet.
Sorry to report my parents didn't have that box of me.
We only had two reviews.
Well, I've got a joke in my current show that I just did a little run of in Edinburgh and I did in Australia that it's a true story. I've got a story about the ashes of my dad that I ended up during December last year doing a Zoom gig. It was a corporate Christmas gig and it was a last minute one. And I hadn't done a Zoom gig since I moved house and, you know, basically during COVID. And I was literally doing a sound check and I couldn't find somewhere to like rest my mic. I had my USB mic out and I used my dad's ashes as basically as a mic stand. And it's a true story. But at the end of this routine, I basically point out, I say, like, you know, it's really nice that my dad finally came to one of my gigs. But it's
great.
But it's a true story. My parents were not, you know, they were proud of me, but it was so outside their remit, they never really engaged with my comedy career.
My dad did comedy, but he never engaged with me at all about it. But I did hear. He spoke to my mum. I don't know. I did about my seventh gig. I used to audio it and I put the earphones in and he's like listening. Yeah. It was the most awkward like 6 minutes of my life. Like it was so weird watching his face.
Yeah, not as awkward as it was for him.
I thought he'd love it.
Or your audience.
Yeah.
but
I basically died on my ass.
Oh my God.
He did say to my mum, he did tell my mum, it's weird, it's like your dad's reviews that he found. Like, I bet he might not have said that to you. You didn't know that he felt like that. I mean, I'm just totally assuming that. But my dad would never say anything to me, but he might talk to other people about it, you know what I mean?
To not book you.
your dad did stand up.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Tommy Dean. But there was also another Tommy Dean comic that is not my dad. But my
I'm glad
dad,
you've got two dads.
But he did it at the Krays, you know, the Kray Twins, their club and stuff. Maybe the 60s, the 70s, a little bit. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that. Milo McCabe's dad.
Yeah, what's his name? Yeah, that's again. Right, I forgot what his dad's name. He's a very mainstream.
Mike McCabe. Yes.
Mike McCabe. Lovely guy. Lovely guy.
Who else? I'm trying to think. Obviously, you've got Elliot Steele, Mark Steele. Annie McGrath.
McGrath. You know Sally Ann Hayward's dad.
Sally Ann Hayward's dad. Who's that?
No, Sally Ann Hayward's godfather is Roger DeCourcy and Nookie Bear.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Bloody hell. Classic Nepo baby. No, I don't know. This doesn't really count if your uncle's just a guy with a puppet. So
that's not fair. I did a gig at a holiday camp and he was on before me and I went early to watch him and he was sublime.
They're all that generation that gets like, you know, they sort of get a bit of shit from not just my generation but below as well. But like, you know, you watch some of them old guard, they're proper like, you know, old pros, isn't it?
They can hold a room, can't they?
Other skills as well, man. You just see them as sort of.
Well, he did half an hour before he got out Nookie Bear. Yeah. So he did half an hour of stand up. Oh, can I just say one of my favorite heckles? No one found this funny. And I was on the floor. And only about 100 of the 500 people would have heard it. But he went, I came out of retirement to do this show. I don't really work anymore. But I was sitting in my conservatory. And the audience all went, ooh, right? And he went, and my landline rang, and this one bloke went, ooh. Isn't that great? Yeah. Isn't that great? Like, check you out of your landline. But and there's no way that no one heard it, because I wasn't sitting near him, and I heard it. I was doubled up. It was just as perfect. It's like a callback 10 seconds later, isn't it?
That's so good.
But yeah, so anyway, so you, how long did it take you to write the book?
About seven and a half months.
What sort of,
yeah,
what was like your writing schedule? Was it like a daily thing? Did you park like a few periods a week? Like how it's, because I remember I wrote a treatment for a book once where I wrote a I never got published, but basically the treatment I wrote was about 50 pages of the book. Essentially it was one full chapter and there was basically a breakdown of each chapter, and that took me so long. I mean, it took me,
what was it about?
It was about, my mom's about veganism. Have you heard of it? But it's I just remember just like it was a real process that I found, like it was a good insight into how it would be to write a book. But you know, I was working on that solidly every day for weeks basically.
I just did a stream of consciousness and then broke it into chapters. Okay. Yeah. Originally it was just like chapters changed from subject when I just thought of the next thing, and it would be, and I just go, and that brings us on to the next chapter, dot, 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 and then the next chapter. And then by the time it's finished, none of that existed. Yeah. So basically it was a stream of consciousness that then got chopped up and then changed.
Nice.
I just rewriting it as I went, you know. I read the early stages and it's like, you know, it's not that good. But they're just every thought I've ever had, but it's just structuring them into, you know, I would say I wrote three quarters of it in the first month and a half, and then the rest of it was just tightening and tightening and tightening.
Okay.
So
there's a lot of books on stand up and that, but you writing one, I'm 100% reading it. Definitely. I'm really excited about it, actually.
Thank you. The thing that's different is I haven't read them all, obviously, but the ones I've browsed through just to have a look at what other people are doing, they're all about how to do it. And mine's how to do it better.
Right, yeah.
And I've warned people, you know, this is an advanced book. I've warned them. And I've actually, there's 17 chapters on writing and 15 on performing. And I've labeled the right ones. So if you're new, you can skip to those ones because they'll help anyone. Yeah. But the things on performing, I'm taking it. People who've never been on stage will go, wow, this is almost like psychic energy you're discussing. Because if you haven't been on stage, you won't understand that.
Yeah. I love it.
17 chapters. Go on, sorry.
No, I was just saying I love it. Yeah, I love that subject.
So what, like in terms of, obviously, like, you know, it's only come out today. And it was it recommended by Amazon? I've put it right up at like the top of the recommendation list.
They put it number one in, right, they had a top 44 and they put it number one in writing. Lovely. And then in Canada and America is number four.
Nice.
So I was over the moon. They call it hot tips or something like that. The thing is that they must have a team of people who just browse through anything that's been, they have to check it anyway. You can't just put a book up. It goes through Amazon, they look at it, because you could be putting
Is it self-published through Amazon? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Which is quite interesting way of doing it. I mean, a lot of people would think, oh, I've got an idea for a book, but I wouldn't even know where to begin, you know, how to even get it published. A lot of people still, I think, assume that you have to go through a publisher officially. And, like, you know, there's a real rigmarole. As I went through when I was trying to get this book published, it was a real, like, you know, it was through a publisher. And then I did all the work and then they just were like, nah, actually, it's not. We don't think it's actually a market for it. So, like, it was all the hard work felt like it was done for nothing. Whereas, if anything, if I'd have started it with thinking, oh, I'm going to write this just for me and then self-publish, I probably would have stuck with it.
Well, I'd like to say something that for anyone listening who's thinking about writing a book, there's a program called Vellum, V-E-L-L-U-M, and it's, as you're typing, you can see it on a screen of an iPad, Kindle, iPhone, page. Then it lays it out for you, so when you start a new chapter it lays them out for you. And it, like, for example, the introduction page is in Roman numerals, and dedication, it lays out, it recognizes the word dedication, it lays it out differently, so it knows everything you're doing. There's no chapter heading or heading you're going to write in a book that hasn't been done before. So
it's like
a
final draft, I guess, for scripts, isn't it?
But the beautiful thing is it's free until you upload it, so try until you buy. So for nothing you can write your book. And then, you know, there weren't that many people involved. There's the cover designer, which I'm glad I use, because I had an idea, but she made it better. Yeah. Because I had the humility to acknowledge that I've never done the cover design. So someone who does it for a living is going to do something that you didn't think of course. So, and then there's a proofreader, which is helpful because you're going to make typos and grammatical errors. And then illustrators, if you need them, you don't need them in a novel. And then you just need someone who knows how to upload it on Amazon. I've got a friend who's an author. But when you break it down, there's only seven people involved in the entire thing, including graphic art on Photoshop and Carta. Seven people. And if you go for a publisher, there's going to be a team of people. They're going to be spending money that you can't choose to spend. They'll decide on the cover design. So my point is, anyone listening, you write it on an app that's free to you, download it. And then when you've decided you definitely want to do it, it's 250 quid. So you can do it on a shoestring if you really want to. You can use social media to promote it. And you can, you know, you can do the cover design yourself. You can do everything yourself, actually, and trust your own grammar. If you wanted to, or you could ask 10 friends to read it and check for grammar and between them, point, circle stuff. You know, you can't, it's a bit like people going on YouTube and becoming successful, making their own videos. It's, you know, you don't need the man anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what, when you say it's like, it's to make comedians better, like who do you, are you, do you want, is it aimed at comedians or is it aimed at everyone who's interested in comedy plus comedians?
The absolute target market would be somebody who's in their first 3 or 4 years of stand-up.
Yeah. And,
but anyone who's never done it before, they will benefit from it. I think, so I've said, read the chapters on writing. When you've done 30 gigs, come back and reread the book and it will all make sense because suddenly that 30 gigs is a lot of knowledge. Yeah. But there's other, you know, people do public speaking a lot. There's a 16-page chapter on corporate comedy, which would be good for anyone who does public speaking. And
I mean, I think I'm so shit at corporates, man. I think I'll be zoning in on that chapter.
Do you know what? I speak in depth about corporates, and I always think to myself, imagine someone buys that who happened to employ me for a corporate that went really badly. They're really going, he didn't apply any of this when he turned up. Yeah, it's terrifying thought.
So what else do you cover in it? Let's talk through it, because obviously, you know, it's, we haven't had a chance to read it yet. It's only just come out. But what's the, so what, so talk us through the stages of it without ruining the actual.
How many chapters?
32.
Ooh, mama.
Okay.
318 pages, 100,000 words. Wow.
Oh, yeah. That's a thick book, then.
It's a thick book. I was working, I probably had 3 days off in the 8 months I've done it, and I probably average 4 hours a day. If I went on a long drive, any drive longer than 25 minutes, so that's not a long drive, any drive longer than 25 minutes, I played it on accessibility mode. There's a disabled mode for people who can't, partially sighted. And I played it. So I do a 5-hour round trip to a gig and I have it playing the whole time. And I make mental notes to change bits. I start learning memory games. So it's amazing what you can remember. If you learn memory games, so you can remember 15 adjustments and then you pull over services, you write them all down. So it was more than a full-time job. Yeah.
Are you thinking about doing the audio book version?
Yeah. But you'd have to have PDF downloads for people to see the visuals, because there are a lot of things where I write stuff out and I put words in bold, and there's chapters on like repetition of words where I show you where. The funny thing is, I learned stuff about what I was talking about while I was writing it. So I had a few E equals MC squared moments as I was explaining stuff. So I went deeper into stuff than I actually thought I was going to go in, because I was working stuff out as I was writing it, which was a lovely feeling, because you're digging as you're going.
Because it's all there at the back in your subconscious, I guess, and you're bringing it out and you're like,
Well, I tell you what made it unusual in my opinion, because I've ghostwritten for so many people. I've ghostwritten for over 50 people, and some of them, you know, multiple times. My record was, I'll count, it was 29 projects with somebody. I've learned to articulate why I've changed something the way I do. And the analogy I give is that if you had to tell someone how to do a shoelace up over the phone without shoelaces in your hand, I couldn't do that. That would be a hell of a job. But because I've explained my methods, I've actually articulated really intricate thoughts. And now I'm just putting those down, because if someone says, why did you change that? I've got to explain why. And then I go, oh, well, actually, the amount of syllables on that side after a pause is more than that side. It doesn't. And I've started to work out formulas and patterns. Comedy is not maths, but there's plenty of music. And I've worked out some of the chords.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I suppose it's that thing of, but then does it obviously lean towards certain styles of comedy, obviously, more than others? Do you know what I mean?
I don't advise on character comedy.
No, but in terms of also like long form storytelling thing, you know, there's things that the formulas or the...
I don't advise on musical comedy.
Musical comedy.
The first draft. Well, there's a difference between musical comedy and song parody. Yeah, let's put those two separate. There was one when the first draft. There was a chapter called song parody, and it just said, "Don't ever do it," and that was it. These chapters like 15 pages each, and so I just don't do it.
But yeah. It's still funny. It's that classic thing as we were talking about sort of old mainstream comedians. I'll still as much as like. Or in theory, it's obviously a style of comedy that you think, but sometimes I'll still just laugh at some dumb shit, man. I'm so easily pleased.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Like, that I'm not a snob at all about what I laugh at. I'm a snob about what I'll discuss afterwards. You know what I mean? It's that thing in the moment, my sense of humour is about as bland and broad as anything could be. But like, then in the post-match analysis, I'm like, that was shit. You know, I was crying laughing at the time.
Yeah.
But in terms of like different styles, so a storyteller, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Is like, you know, do the formulas and the sort of style of, you know, when you say you've got chords and start like you equating it to music, how would that work with someone who's doing a 20-minute story about one thing?
Well, that's a good question. I think the longest chapters on storytelling, right. And although my stories are short, if I do, you've probably never even seen me tell a story, but I do sometimes tell stories, but they're short. But I still apply theory that would be in a 20-minute story. I mean, I know you're a proper storyteller, and you do like 8-minute stories sometimes. But I think it'd be interesting to see what you think when you look at it. I think that I've covered every aspect of storytelling. Okay. Yeah. I mean, my pet hate is when Tom tells a story as it happens, and the only punchlines are what other people said and what actually happened, and then they're not putting anything of their own in.
Yeah. Also, because I've always treated a story as like if it's a funny story, I want to tell it. But I also treat it as a vehicle to do observational stuff during it. It's like a sort of journey, isn't it? And you're pointing out funny things that are related, but doesn't always have to be crucial to the story.
Well, I say to people, watch your favourite comedian telling a story. My camera, there you go. I say, watch your favourite comedian telling a story and just stop to look at how many punchlines, tangents, detailed descriptions of what's going on. They're not just saying what happened.
No.
They're not. They're saying their thoughts on what happened. And I talk as a two-track. I do a diagram. It's a two-track recorder. And the one track is what happened. And the other track is your thoughts while it happened.
Like when they hypothesize and, their thoughts on...
Yeah.
Bill Burr does that. His whole story would be his imaginings about the situation.
So I think that the thing about a good storyteller is they make it look like they're just saying what happened. And because they're so good at crafting it, an untrained eye will go, they're just telling what happened. They go, you know, you do it, Carl. Jason Manford does it, and so then you get these inexperienced comedians who just say what happened, and this did this, and then I said that, and you go, there's no depth, and there's no, the layers that are going on. So when I say track one and two, if you talk about what happened and you make a funny comment about exactly what you let's say you're setting the scene and then you make a joke, that's track one and two merging, because you said where you were, then you say something funny immediately afterwards. That's track one. They merge. So a story is one track, but it's made of two. Yeah. And your job is to merge them together. But although
isn't it? As is a one-liner joke.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't cover character comedy. I talk about something that character comedians do that they shouldn't do. What's that? Well, there's a chapter called boom mic moments. So you know when a boom mic appears in a film and you're watching a film and it just pops in like that, and you go, oh god, it's just acting now. You know, it ruins it for you. But you always knew it was acting, but you forgot it was acting. So a boom mic moment for me is when a comedian reminds you that what they've just said they've done 100 times before. And I mean, an ego related boom mic moment is a comedian going, oh, that joke normally works.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, you know, or you're in the middle of a story referring to somebody as a joke. It's not a joke to them. It's a story.
Yeah.
Like Gary Delaney referring to it a joke, fine, it's a joke. But
I prefer the joke, but if you're telling a story and the bloke did this and the bloke did this and then he did this and then she turned around and she said this and that joke normally works because they're not jokes, they're moments of the story.
Yeah.
But saying normally works is not only insulting your audience, saying that they're a bad audience, you also remind that audience that you just said the same thing last night.
So a
boom mic moment with character comedians is, I've seen character comedians, I'm not going to name them, they'll say, unlike the other comedians tonight.
Oh, yeah.
You're supposed to be an electrician who's popped down to fix the stage.
Or,
that joke. If your character, like Al Murray, the pub landlord, got it down to an art form. And I remember when the audience were really laughing hard, he'd go like this and look like he's annoyed. And I said to him, why did you do that? It's fascinating. He said, because my character's so thick, he's getting annoyed that they're laughing at him because he doesn't know why they're laughing at him. So, it's like your aggressive people who aren't too bright and they just get... They don't understand why you're laughing at them. Just what's going on? Like, those people are mocking me. I don't know why. But the point is that referring to a joke not working, if you're pretending to be an electrician, let's say you've wandered on and you're supposed to be an electrician fixing the microphone, and the compound rings you on and says, there's been a technical problem, please welcome, come in. And he walks on, fixing the microphone. He can't refer to the last time he did a joke about fixing the microphone.
It destroys the character.
So that's the closest I get to character comedy. But yeah.
I suppose it depends, unless if it's done consciously as a sort of almost a corpsing type thing, where it's part of the meta character. I suppose there is ways
meta's
it
great.
Can be done, but it has to be done. Yeah. Like you have to be on the same wavelength as the audience, I suppose.
Yeah, but the thing is that if you, for example, a boom mic moment, I watched some the other day be improv in and out of their material so smoothly I couldn't tell what was material, what was improv. It was genuine improv, and the joins that just was sublime. And at the very, very end of their set, they told a story and everyone laughed, but it wasn't a big laugh. And they went, oh, I normally end on that.
Right, yeah.
And I'm like, everything up till then, that's just a mic just popped in. We didn't know what was... I'm not saying you should pretend your material's improv, but don't remind them that what you're telling them as a general story that I it's a bit like having sex with someone and then whispering in your ear, oh, this is my ex's favourite position.
That's Julian's favourite line to say during sex. He opens with that.
But anyways, to answer your question, no, it doesn't cover everything. It doesn't cover musical comedy. I can't talk about musical comedy. I've never done it. I can't talk about character comedy. I'm talking about everything I know. But I don't just talk about my style. I talk about all styles.
Yeah.
Just not character comedy.
That's good. What tips could you give me and Julian to improve our styles? What should we be doing?
The thing is, what I love about you two is you're both very different comedians, right? You're anecdotal and Julian tells one and two line jokes. You actually couldn't be more different.
Emotionally, personally, comedically.
Brendan Burns said to me, I saw a new comedian the other day, and he's the closest thing I've seen to the way your mind works when you structure jokes. And it was Julian.
Ah.
Have I told you that before, Julian?
I think so, yeah.
You had a line about, you mentioned an African country. I can't remember. My girlfriend, she said, my boyfriend went to Mozambique and all I got was this lousy AIDS.
I remember that joke.
what I love is lousy is such an understatement.
Lousy, yeah.
Having
HIV.
That's lousy. But that's what makes it brilliant, right? The twist is great, but the choice of the word lousy. But Julian's thought, that was the closest thing you've seen to my style of thinking.
Right, yeah.
Julian, Brendan.
Brendan, yeah. I remember seeing you before I ever did stand up.
Yeah, you studied me.
And I thought I could do that.
Well, you know what? Talking about being similar to someone and not, obviously our energy is different, but just structurally, I got flown to Miami to do Last Comic Standing, and you do a 3-minute audition to two people. You stand on a podium with a camera crew and two judges, a producer and two producers, I think. And I did my 3-minute audition. They flew me, they paid me, they put me up, they paid my flight, no fee. They flew me to Miami. I did my 3-minute set and they went, "Don't you think you're a little bit similar to someone else?" And I went, "No, who?" And they went, "Dave Attell." Now, we look a bit similar. His comedy's way more edgy, way more opinionated.
The whole attitude is completely different.
Completely different. I'd been doing stand-up for about 10 years before he was drawn to my attention. So I know
there's no influence.
I hadn't heard of him for 10 years. And I was like, well, no. And I redid one of my jokes in his voice to sort of say how he would have said it differently. It wasn't a masterful example, but I redid my joke so he would, in his joke, that would have been the victim rather than the other way. And I thought, you flew me to Miami to tell me that. They'd obviously seen me. They didn't discover it in that 3 minutes. Do you know what I mean? They chose me. They watched me on YouTube and went, let's fly him to Miami and tell me shit.
Arguably, it's the best heckle of all time.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
That shows you what producers know, though, really, isn't it?
Insane.
Well, I've got a theory. If comedy producers knew anything about stand-up, they'd still be doing it.
Yeah. It's so true. We would have got to the Laughing Horse quarterfinals.
I've just seen some quick. There's got some questions on our group. One of them is from Timmy. Says, "Love Adam Bloom. He's an amazing joke writer. I've seen him storm Ball and Banana a couple of times. He's also a big hip hop head. Please, can you ask him about his history with hip hop?"
I was a breakdancer.
Really?
Yeah. I was a breakdancer. I was a graffiti. I've got a criminal record for graffiti.
Right, that bad was it.
I went to court at 17 years old and found guilty of criminal damage.
God, where did you where did you graffiti first off?
In Richmond, where I grew up.
Big graffiti.
So I've been into hip hop. I actually talk about hip in my book because flow in hip hop is such a. You interview any rapper about flow, about their music. They'll always talk about. If you ask a rapper their favorite rappers, they'll always say flow. That flow will always come up, and so I there's a whole chapter on
Flow. When you say flow, you mean like the state of flow, the mental state of flow?
The music of words. So Mitch Hedberg.
The Michael called flow, you mean?
No, like the actual flow of the work.
Oh, so the rappers talk about flow, the rhythm, the flow.
So Mitch Hedberg got a unique flow.
Right, yes.
I used to do drugs. I still do drugs, but I used to do.
Yeah.
That's his rhythm. And like his jokes. I taught myself to play bass, which was a bad idea because I can't play. Right? Yeah, they both sound the same. That's his. He's not just got good flow. He's got a unique flow. And you know, look at rappers, Biggie Smalls, Eminem. They've got their own flow. So, but your friend here asking about the hip hop. I didn't know this was live.
It's not live, but we put a thing out earlier saying we were doing the podcast and you were coming on. So we got a few questions in advance.
Oh, that's great. So I discovered Run DMC when I was 13, and it just. There was a line when he went on DMC, the place to be, I go to St. John's University. And I thought, someone's telling me where they're studying at the moment. And I was like, I've never shared this moment. I mentioned them in my book, but I went, wow, you're talking about your school. And I like people say, like, a lot of people, hip-hop's all the same. And they go, guns and da-da-da. And they mention it. Yeah, there are repetitions of subject matter. But when you think about it, probably 80% of songs are about love. Mm. And yet, hip hop, you know, infinite subject matters. Infinite. Yeah. Tribe Called Quest, I left my wallet in El Segundo. A song about leaving his wallet somewhere. There are singers who do, what's the name? Bill Withers did a song about his grandmother's hands called Grandma's Hands. Have you heard this song? The whole song is about his grandmother's hands. Each verse, each line, every line, every single line starts with Grandma's Hands. So he said, Grandma's hands clapped in church every morning. So, Sunday morning, so you know she's religious because her hands are clapping, or her hand would issue out a warning, so she'd tell him off. So he's describing her character, but it's always through her hands. So there are inventive songs, of course there are, but the thing about hip hop is, if you took two albums and listed every track, they're far more unusual choices of subject matter than the average song, which is I love you, I love you, I love you, I lost you, I lost you, I love you, I got back with you. You know, I would say if you went in the charts, at least 60% of the songs would be about some form of love or emotion towards somebody else that they're. And yet, hip-hop's so inventive. Yes. So inventive. So I got into hip-hop when I was 13, then got into breakdancing, graffiti. So hip-hop, I'm 52, and hip-hop's still a significant part of my life. I listen to hip-hop every day of my life.
What's your take on, do you like modern hip-hop? Is it, are you sort of, because I know some people sort of who were classic hip-hop fans and that, do struggle a bit more with modern hip hop and sort of veer towards the classical stuff rather than, you know, things like
I'm slightly stuck in the late 80s. Yeah, I'm slightly stuck in the late 80s, early 90s. De La Soul, Tribe Quest. Public Enemy, Beastie Boys, Eric B. and Rakim. But there's some new people. There's a guy called J. Cole.
I know J. Cole.
He's a modern philosopher. He's got a song called Love Yours with a Z. It should be the anthem for lockdown. It got me. I know it sounds a bit dramatic, but it got me through lockdown because it was a song about being grateful for the people you got around you. And the chorus is no such thing as a life that's better than yours, which is that's philosophy in itself. No such thing as a life that's better than yours. You fantasize about being rich and all these people you see on TV. I wish I was like them. Rather than the cliche of like money's not everything, no such thing as a life that's better than yours. I love that. I remember. Maybe I shouldn't say his name because it wasn't for me to say, but a stadium filling comedian said to me, I'm no happier than I was when I started, before I got successful. I'm no happier.
Yeah, but I'd say that's quite common with
it is common.
Super high achievers. You know what I mean? That thing of often the thing that takes, you know, obviously, I mean, you have to be an amazing comedian and be able to connect with people to a certain degree. Like all them comedians we know we've got mates who are arena selling comedians. And, you know, on a technical level, you could probably name a couple of comedians who you think are as good as them that are just your average club headliners, right? That you think technically are as good.
Sure.
But often the thing that slightly differentiates them is the one who's got, like, you know, to that level has just this certain accessibility or likability or charisma. There's something just slightly different that makes people just warm to them way more and remember them as well. People will walk out.
Yeah, sure.
Like that guy. But yeah, I mean, like, I think often the people that really chase that and get there, they're going to chase it regardless of how successful they are. They could be, yeah, their lack of happiness comes from somewhere so different to their success.
Yeah. But we're making 2 points now. And by the way, when I said it is common and it sounds like I'm contradicting myself, I know it's common, but he said it was such. It was profound when he said it to me because it was just like looking at me, this multi-millionaire going, I'm no happier. And I suppose it wouldn't surprise me if someone else said it, but he said it so down to earth. It was so down to earth. But yeah, with regard to those people that are driven, I tell you what's interesting. I had a 4-day window between a 3-day window between finishing my book and being able to plug it because it was available. And in that 3 days, I felt like I had nothing to do. Because my life's been so full for 8 months, I felt empty. When I pressed that button, click, I actually felt like I was saying goodbye to something.
Yes. Right, that's the end of this week's public episode. We hope you enjoyed it. What happens now, Julian?
They can, if they want to hear the rest of the episode, they can go over to patreon.com/wearetvi.
There you go. Once you've signed up there, you can hear the rest of the episode. You can hear all the old Patreon episodes, exclusives, whatever.
It's 45p a week.
Is it? Mm. That's cool. Mm. I didn't know that.
Easy life.
There we go. It's even cheaper than I thought. So do that. But if not, don't worry. You can listen to next week's public episode when it's released. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bro, I used to die of AIDS in an alleyway. I'm alright, bro.